This is the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Anfield.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the fourth episode of Analyzing Anfield. I'm your host, Christian Walsh, and with me, as always, is Josh Williams. Josh, how are you doing?
Doing good, mate, yeah. Episode four, so we're into the series now.
They're sticking with us, aren't they? Yeah, they haven't cancelled us yet. We're not off the air. And we've got to keep the name Anfield, Analyzing Anfield, we think, anyway. As always, if you've got any better suggestions, we haven't had any yet, but if you've got any better suggestions, we'll probably ignore them. We'll dive straight in, to be honest. We didn't have one last week because I was over in Bavaria watching Liverpool win in Munich, which was a fantastic experience. I don't think I can stomach another sausage or another plate of potatoes for quite a while, but that aside, cracking trip, cracking results. Josh, we'll just gloss over it really because it was a week ago, but you know, very quick words. It felt like one of the most mature performances in Europe of Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool reign.
It was, yeah. It was the first time that we've been, you know, performing in Europe and we've looked like a real elite side. Like when you watch the likes of Bayern, Real Madrid, Barcelona, teams like that over the years, they've just got an assurance about them. And when PSG went to Old Trafford, for example, I remember last season, I think Juventus went to Old Trafford too. They've just got a way about them where they just step above the occasion and just ultimate control of everything that's happening. And this was the first time I've really saw Liverpool have that in Europe under Klopp. And I think, I tweeted at the time, I think it'll do more for how we're perceived than reaching the final did last season. Because although we reached the final last season, we didn't beat any world beaters along the way apart from City, who obviously an incredible team, but in terms of status they're not yet there. And then once we did reach a team like that in the final, we obviously got beat. Salah went off injured, but we still lost the game. So I think it'll do wonders for our stature in Europe, and it was really impressive to see how we performed on the day.
It does put a thumb to the eye, really, of people. I remember when Klopp first came and there were doubts about him in terms of game management and control and building a defence. And it's strange because obviously at Dortmund, he had a fantastic defence for a while in terms of Hummels. He had Subotic, Piszczek, and who was the other lad on the left-hand side? Schmelzer. You know, Weidenfeller behind them. And they got to a Champions League final and they didn't do it sort of, you know, they got some good results on the way. They obviously beat Real Madrid, but it feels he is entering that upper echelon of manager at Liverpool, where he's not only just seen as this passionate guy who rallies the crowd and plays great attacking football, but over two legs, he feels like he's one of the most unbeatable managers in Europe. You know, just he hasn't lost a knockout game of football, two-legged knockout game of football in Europe as Liverpool manager.
Yeah, that really is an incredible record. That, I mean, we've faced a fair amount of teams that you'd say are on our level, maybe. But we've still faced a fair few tough times. Dortmund, when they were a better side than us, faced Man United as well. Bayern now.
I think Villarreal were a decent team.
They were tough and they beat us in the away leg first too. But yeah, we really are a side to be reckoned with, especially over two legs. And just super proud of the team, to be honest, recently. In that match it was, yeah. Not necessarily at Fulham.
Yeah. Well, we will move on to Fulham. It wasn't a performance to make any of us proud, but it's a performance, or more like a result, that will absolutely do for any Liverpool fan all across the globe, to be honest. 3 points, Liverpool back top of the league. Looking at it, you know, tactically, Josh, 2-1, late penalty, nervy times, but ultimately the gulf between the two sides was far bigger than the scoreline suggested.
Yeah, I mean, we're a far better team and, you know, we controlled the majority of the match. I think the only time the match went a bit chaotic was when, I mean, you was there, wasn't you? Mm. You said about the weather, it just suddenly started pouring down and Fulham started playing a little bit more direct. We only had the one goal lead and it just started getting a bit mad. But up until that point, we was controlling the game easily. They allowed us to progress into the final third, constantly using the flanks. I'm assuming that they did that because, you know, our attack's perceived as very central, and you know, Mane comes inside, Firmino's inside already, Salah comes inside, so if you block off the centre you're safe. But that's not the case because we've got two top quality fullbacks who lead our ball progression numbers as well, and we just used them repetitively.
More crosses than any game this season.
Yeah. I looked into that actually yesterday. I think we attempted 34 in the match. And the previous high was about 30, I think. We don't usually hit that many at all. So, I mean, that's not very encouraging for me, if I'm honest. Anyone that's followed analytics for a while will know that crossing's like a low percentage, you know, reliability and that kind of thing. So you never ever really want to rely on crossing, and that's why gradually as the game's got more developed and, you know, more thorough in terms of analysis, more teams have gotten away from crossing as a means of attacking. So, but it does offer a bit of insight though into, you know, that's how much space we was afforded in those areas.
I mean, the first goal, nothing to necessarily back this up, which I shouldn't say on this podcast because we try and back everything up, but it felt to me that it was the first time that Mane really was given the ball. It felt like he was very much on the periphery for the first 20 minutes. But the second he does, he looks so dangerous, and it just shows how important he's becoming. We've spoken about Mane at length, really, on this podcast before, and how he can be a bit of a strange player to analyse and a strange player to understand, but you can't argue with these. So he's played 88% of minutes available in the league this season. He's been involved in 27% of Liverpool's goals. You know, now he's now joint Liverpool, you know, top scorer. Did you see this coming? Did you see Sadio Mane becoming this sort of goal scorer supreme?
No. Usually with things like this, you can kind of predict it using things like expected goals, and you usually get an understanding using that kind of thing of whether a player is inclined to get himself into scoring chances and things like that. That's one of the reasons we initially signed Mo Salah, because he was posting such good underlying numbers. In the case of Mane, he just posts good underlying numbers, really. Not the most shots, his XG is good, but again, his box involvement is good, but he's not like elite tier in terms of a scoring threat. So this at the minute was, you know, quite unpredictable, really. I don't like calling it like a nice patch, but it's likely that that's what it is. And if you look at his conversion rate as well, I had a little look before on Y Scouts, and I put in Mane's played about 2,400 minutes or something like that this season. So I had a little look on Y Scout and went on the search and all that, and I put in the filters of players that have played 1,500 minutes, two shots per match. Mane averages a little bit over two, with a higher conversion rate than Mane in Europe's top five leagues. Only five. Kylian Mbappe, Marco Reus, I've seen Ben Yedder, Raheem Sterling, and Stuani. So
former Middlesbrough player,
I think so.
I think it is Christian Stuani.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he's at. I think he's in Italy. But anyway, what I'm getting at there, if you look at those players, say for example, Reus, Mbappe, and Sterling, they're all in. Especially Mbappe and Sterling, they're all in high quality teams that are probably creating high quality chances. City creates a ton of tap-ins. PSG the same, loads of tap-ins and things like that. So it's almost expected for them to have high conversion rates. Ben Yedder and Christian Stuani remains to be seen. I don't watch them too often. I do think Ben Yedder is actually quite a good finisher, I think, from what I'm aware of.
He was the one who knocked out Man United at Old Trafford, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Came off the bench. And
but what I'm getting at is I don't think Mane, I mean, to post such a conversion rate, I think his conversion rate is something like 25% or something like that. Just above 25% it is. Salah's, for example, is 18. I think Harry Kane's is usually around 18. Timo Werner's, looked at today, was 16, I think. You don't usually get players, you know, finishing at such an elite level. So if a player is finishing at that level, they're either doing so because the lucky, or because when I say lucky, having like a lucky patch, like a lucky period, or they're exceptional finishes. I'm not particularly certain which end Mane is at the minute.
It could be either, couldn't it?
Could be a mixture of both. But just the conversion rate of that level suggests that it's probably not going to continue. I mean, you'd expect that to come down. When it does, you know, he'd then not necessarily regress, but he'd revert to the mean, if you like. But it's, I mean, it's obviously good that he's performing to this level and he's overperforming, if you like, and hopefully it continues.
It's interesting looking at his numbers, Mane, between this season and last season, and it makes you do wonder if Klopp has certainly in recent months decided to slightly tweak his role. I'll just throw out a couple of numbers here, so just bear with me. His XG last season was per 90 minutes was 0.36, and this season is 0.48. But he's averaging around one more dribble last season than he is this. He's also making fewer progressive runs. He's assisting far fewer shots, and his expected assists have also halved. So it feels almost like his creativity has almost been stripped back here, but he's now been designated as somebody to grab the goals for Liverpool. It's almost as if they've looked at the goals that Liverpool scored last season and thought, right, okay, we can get a little bit more out of Mane. Salah got 44, Firmino got 27, Mane did manage to hit the 20. We can do this now. This is how we're going to do it. So do you feel like that's played a part? Do you feel like he's almost become Liverpool's goal scorer?
I think he's always been, you know, his primary role for me has always been to score. I don't think he's ever been much of a creator, Mane. He's always been, you know, a very penetrative player, running in behind, things like that.
I think it's only one assist this season. I mean, I don't know what assists can be, but I mean, you know, his expected assists aren't great either.
Yeah, well, I had looked before at his expected assists. You know, for those that, you know, aren't aware, expected assists, an assist is only ever registered, obviously, if the ball goes in the net, if the goal's scored. Expected assists considers every chance that a player creates, obviously attains like a value to each chance. And then that player then for each match has got an expected assists value. And then roughly based on that, you can get a gauge of the quality of the chances that a player's creating. And players this season, I had a little look at this in the Premier League, that have played roughly the same amount of minutes as Mane, but have a higher expected assists. Matt Doherty, Ashley Westwood. Matt Ritchie, Andros Townsend, Gian Moutinho. These are all right players, but these aren't playing an attacking role for Liverpool. He should be, for me, creating more, whether he's the scorer or not, or whether he's been assigned a specific role or not, I'm not too sure. Salah last season was the scorer. Salah up until, you know, a few weeks ago was the scorer, but he's always still chipped in fair amount with assists, and this is why Mane is such a difficult player to determine, because he is a scorer, obviously, and I think that the role of Mane and Salah, I don't think it's that different in your standard 4-4-3. I think they're both tasked with just being inside.
It's all like a mirror image, isn't it? You know what Salah does on the right, Mane does on the left.
Yeah,
cuts inside. You make the width from the fullbacks, and you get in the box.
Yeah, exactly. But I just think it's a case of, since Salah's been signed, I think Salah's better at it. That's it. And Mane's not bad by any means at all. I just think Salah's better at the specific, you know, inside forward role, if you like. And very recently, you know, Salah does seem to have dropped off a cliff, not just in terms of output either, but in terms of like your underlying output too. His XG is quite low and things like that. But just going back to Mane, as I said, he's a strange player to determine. He's weird.
Well, the narrative then, it's interesting you bring up Salah there, because the narrative now, and I retweeted a Sky Sports poll, and, you know, God, that is never a gauge of popular opinion, but, you know, I think the poll was basically saying, which of these four players would you rather have in your attack? And it was Aguero, Sterling, Mane and Salah. Salah got 7% of the vote, which is, Mane got, I think it was like 19%. Aguero got over 50% of the vote. I mean, number one, that's recency bias for me, because if you would have asked this question 3 months ago, I think Salah would have been battling Aguero for top spot. But the narrative is there, isn't it, in terms of Salah's having a terrible season, Mane's now the main man. Just want to throw a couple of these, you know, this stat here, in terms of Mane hasn't been involved in 27% of Liverpool's goals. Mo Salah, now okay, he's been involved in more minutes as well, 95% of minutes compared to 88% from Mane. But compared to 27% of Liverpool's goals that Mane has been a part of, Salah's been involved in 35%. So he's creating, he's having more of an impact in terms of assists and goals. A very simplistic and pure way of looking at how you can contribute. But that is there at 35%. Is the fact that Mo Salah is being so shepherded by opposition defenders, is that helping Sadio Mane now? Because basically, sometimes you look at Salah and he's got 3 players around him, and if everybody shifts over to the right hand side, Liverpool's right hand side, to look after Salah and try and cut off the angles, ensure he can't get a shot away, that's going to leave Firmino in space. That's certainly going to leave Mane in space. We've seen Mane score a couple of goals in recent weeks where he's sort of drifted in between sleeping defenders and scored headers and darted in between, you know, static defence. Whereas last season, maybe everybody was focusing on Mane and therefore Salah had loads of room to operate. Has the opposite happened now? And is the fact that Salah's having a couple of struggles in terms of being kept a bit more quiet and having a bit more, you know, attention put on him, is that helping Mane a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things that need saying just to clear things up as well. Firstly, what you've just said there about Salah attracting attention and Mane being free as a result, that's something that, you know, I didn't actually consider. That didn't actually come to mind for me. I didn't think of that until I saw your tweet. That does make sense. That's certainly plausible. But I think it's important to stress that Salah is very much still the king, if you like.
Yeah, literally, he is the Egyptian king.
I mean, yeah, well, yeah. But you've got to consider that ultimately in football, you're a victim of your own success. Mm-hmm. Pochettino and Spurs are a testament to that. But in Salah's case, Salah's being judged on what we expect of him. What we expect of him is a record-breaking goal-scoring season, because it's the only season he's had with us. Mane's being judged on decent seasons. Do you know what I mean? He hasn't surpassed our expectations of him once, apart from maybe right now. And
we'll just run him through. 13 goals in 27 games in his first season with 6 assists.
That was Mane.
For his first season, that's not bad at all. Second season, 10 goals, 7 assists. So, you know, he hasn't broken his best output in terms of goals and assists is 19, and that was in his first season. He's already on 19 this season. So, you know, with seven games to go.
He's currently having his best season then, really.
That's in the league.
Well, that's how you can look at it. But, you know, I've been working on creating my own, like, player radars lately, profile radars that just provide an outline into a player's role for a start, and then how well he's performing that role in comparison to others that are maybe in similar roles. Despite Mane's superb season, supposedly, Salah, you know, more shots, more dribbles, slightly more XG per 90, slightly more box involvement per 90, double the expected assists per 90. And another thing as well, it's important to say that last season when Salah scored the ridiculous number of goals, we have to stress that he was overperforming at that time. The amount that he scored in the league was
32 in the league, 44 in all comps.
See, 44 in all comps is incredible, and I'm looking at his
Messi
XG
numbers. Messi and Ronaldo numbers, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm looking at his XG now. His XG per 90 last season was 0.58. So you can understand that everyone has 58% chance per match of scoring, basically, based on last season. This season, it is 52% chance of scoring, so not much of a difference there. But last season, despite being expected to score 0.58 per match, he was scoring 0.92. That's borderline double.
Yeah.
He's overperforming ridiculously. And we have stressed already in the three episodes we've done that, you know, XG is so valuable because it provides an insight into underlying performance, and it gradually proves itself usually to be accurate. Usually at some stage, teams or players regress to the mean in terms of what XG is predicted. And last season, although Salah was having a great season and his underlying performance is still great, last season he was considerably overperforming the amount of goals he was expected to score in terms of what he actually scored.
Because you think about some of the goals he did score, phenomenal goals, weren't they? You know, yeah. And you're seeing it this season where he's sort of trying to cut in on his right, on his left foot, and they're getting blocked because the defenders know what's happening, or they're going straight to the keeper. It's just not quite the same. And I think it's important to say, I think regress to the mean can sometimes have an automatic negative connotation. The mean might be absolutely phenomenal. Exactly. His mean is absolutely incredible. I think when people think, oh, he's regressed to the mean, it means, oh, he's bang average. That's not what it means. Regress to the mean is ultimately what he should be doing, and what he should be doing is still an elite performer.
Yeah, when I say regress to the mean, I mean his mean.
Yeah.
And his mean is higher than an absolute ton of players.
Mm.
And, you know, what I was saying before, this season I said his XG is 0.52 and he's scoring 0.58. So he's still overperforming, but it's virtually, you know, there's not much there. He's virtually performing as expected.
Mm.
In fact, funnily enough, that 0.58 that he's scoring, his current rate, is what his XG was last season. His XG last season was 0.58. So he's performing right now. Well, not necessarily right now because he's in bad form at the minute. But he's performing this season in terms of goals how the numbers suggested he would perform last season. You know, which is interesting. Like, but as I said, it's important to stress that no matter how much form plays a part in it, and how many, not necessarily patches, but, you know, good streaks of form Mane has, certainly according to the underlying numbers, Salah is still the undisputed, you know, prime attacker.
And he hasn't really, you know, aside from goals, he's setting up more chances this season in terms of he's making that final pass for a shot on goal more times now per 90 than he was last season. More progressive runs, almost identical average number of dribbles, so it's not like he's dribbling less. All right, he's got a slightly less success rate, slightly lower success rate, but he's ultimately the same player, and as you say, it's just a case of what he was doing last season was far beyond anyone's wildest dreams, and he's still obviously a fantastic player who's just in a run of form at the moment. Maybe going away with Egypt might help him. Well, he's not going away with Egypt, but maybe the couple of weeks off.
Yeah.
So maybe a couple of days at Melwood might help him. I mean, interesting stuff. Looking at what happens after, you know, away from the Salah and Mane debate. Obviously, it goes to 1-0, as we said. Liverpool play pretty well, but within themselves. But then here comes the rain, here comes the hail, and here comes Fulham. Scott Parker, don't know what type of manager he could be, don't know what type of coach he could be, but judging on what type of player he is, you feel like he's somebody who, at the very least, will motivate his players, certainly more than Ranieri did, and what Jokanović managed to do towards the end of his spell at Craven Cottage. So the mistake happens. Who do you think's to blame, Josh? And before I ask the question, up to define it as both of their mistakes, which I've never seen before.
Yeah,
I think that's a
fit. That.
You'd never see that. So Opta basically couldn't decide who was at fault, so both of them have sort of been given it. I can sort of see where they're coming from as well.
Yeah, well, I think that the reason I've done that is because it ultimately stems from a misunderstanding.
Mm.
And you know, you don't really get a misunderstanding on one party. A misunderstanding is a two-party thing. So, but it stems, and it's ultimately, for me, Milner's fault. What is he doing? Honestly, what is he doing?
First touch and a half, that, isn't it?
Well
it's half a first touch, that's the problem.
Well, he said, didn't he, in the post-match thing, that he got told to calm it down by Klopp as he was going on the pitch. And he came on, I think, against Everton. I think it was Everton.
It was a good decision.
He was messy. He was all over the place.
It's interesting.
Every touch he was having, he was, giving it away, or you could tell he was like two steps behind the play and things like that. And it hasn't helped us recently, bringing him on. And for that to be his first touch, just to absolutely sky it and end up going behind you in that weather, you don't need that. You really don't need it.
I've always thought this of Firmino as well, and he did score off the bench against PSG in the Champions League. But in general, one game in particular sticks out in my mind. It was West Brom away last season. And I know it was one of those games where Liverpool were sort of a second gear of that, because they had the Champions League game coming up against Roma. But Firmino, to me, and he did it again at Goodison, of course, this season, and Milner, they don't feel like players, you know, who can get to the pace of the game easily.
Yeah,
they need the rhythm. They need to start the game. And it feels to me, it's interesting that Klopp said that and that Milner said that, because Milner, for me, I can see where they're coming from in terms of Liverpool need to protect the lead, or they need a bit of control, bring on James Milner. But it feels like if he comes into the game when it's in full progress, he's not the type of player who can do that. Something worth pointing out is that, despite what people think, I think in general he's seen as a bit of a safe player and he'll go side to side. He's actually one of Liverpool's key men in terms of progressing the ball with passes. You know, you've got the fullbacks who obviously progress up the pitch, but Milner's in the top four. He's certainly by far the midfielder who progresses the ball the most. So he's not actually really necessarily a player who does that. He's somebody who will try and find the gaps and doesn't necessarily just try and keep possession. So it is a bit of an interesting sub to make, isn't it?
Well, it to an extent, it stresses Liverpool's need that we've had for years for a pass master, if you like. That player that you would like to throw on and say, you know, calm it down or whatever, it's not really Milner. And we haven't got that player. We haven't got like a...
Could be Henderson.
It could be, yeah. I mean, both Henderson and Milner, one thing you can give them, they both have a serious amount of touches in terms of like getting involved in the play, especially Henderson. Henderson's right up there in Europe for most passes per 90 and stuff like that, which, you know, you can deem that as important as you want, but it does highlight to an extent how involved the player is.
Well, if he's making the passes, Liverpool got the ball and the opposition can't score.
Well, if you think to yourself, even when you're playing yourself down the park with your mates or on a five-a-side pitch or anything like that, I think that it's a skill to get touches. It's a skill to get on the ball, and more often than not, the good players end up having a lot of touches. The bad players end up, you know, wanting the ball but not necessarily getting it. Obviously, it plays a part with your position and stuff like that, but, you know, demanding the ball, showing for the ball, being in a position whereby you can receive it and things like that is a skill in itself. And the fact that Henderson has so many touches regularly, it's a positive thing, but he's not the composed Xabi Alonso, middle-end Pjanic, that kind of player. Modric, Cruz,
Fabinho's not like that, is he? He's a great passer of the ball, but he can give the ball away now and then as well.
Yeah, I'd say Fabinho's probably the closest we've got in terms of he can just put his foot on the ball, and if someone calls him down, he won't panic. He'll keep doing what he's doing.
Could it be Wijnaldum? I know you've got views on Wijnaldum in general, which probably not worth getting into on this podcast, but it will be at some point soon. But is Wijnaldum off the bench one of those potential changes to sort of solidify the midfield, calm it down and find control?
Yeah, well, Wijnaldum's the ultimate safe passer. He's Mr. Conservative, if you like. And I don't mean that way either.
We don't know which way he votes.
Yeah, we're not going to go down that way, don't think. But earlier in the season when we were, I think it was this season, we were without Henderson in the early stages, and Wijnaldum had to play at the six a couple of times. And when he did, he did demonstrate a level of composure and press resistance, and he had a lot more touches than he usually gets and things like that. But I just mean that, yeah, Wayne Allen probably is closest when you think about it, because he doesn't panic when he's on the ball. Like, he's just, the problem I have with Wayne Allen on the ball is he's so safe and he's so cautious, and that's good in some aspects, but it's bad in other situations too. I'll mention what I said to you the other day. I wrote a piece on Wayne Allen. It was about 2 years ago now. But he'd played, I think it was 76 games in the Premier League for Newcastle and Liverpool. And at the time of writing, after playing 76 matches, he completed a total of 6 through balls. Now, that above Everton suggests he's not inclined to go forwards really. Doesn't really get many assists and things like that, and his expected assist rate is like 0.08 or something. Like, it's not even worth delving into. So it depends how you use him. But in terms of that control on the play, pass master kind of thing, he'd probably be a better option to bring on than Milner. The only problem was Wijnaldum started, so. Mm.
It should be pointed out as well that he's actually quite high in Liverpool in terms of forward passing, but the through balls metric is an interesting one, because it just shows you that, you know, passing forwards can be a different thing to making incisive passes, if that makes sense. You can pass forward, but if you're passing forward to the number 8 or the...
Well, passing forward
to the fullback, that's different than doing it to an actually into space,
yeah,
and onto an on-rushing attacker. So, you know, Liverpool, one thing you can say about Milner, to be fair to him, he's lethal from the penalty spot. I didn't watch the penalty, to be honest. I thought Salah had scored it until I got back on the coach, because I just refused to watch it. My head went, it's a title race, what are you going to do? But all in all, is it the type of result where you wince, Josh, and go, oh, 7 more of them? Or is it one of those where you do just, you take into account, and I know everybody laughs at the idea of weather, adverse weather conditions being a problem, but I thought that they were. I think it was no surprise that, and certainly no coincidence, that Liverpool's worst spell came when it was hailing and raining and the second balls were all falling to Fulham. Is it the type of game that you just get out with the 3 points and you go, right, 2 weeks off, title race to engage with when we get back?
Yeah, that's it. Just stay in it. That's basically the crux of it. Especially when your best player's perceived to be out of form and he's not really making bad decisions on the ball and things like that. And you can tell he's feeling... I mean, I think decision-making is impacted quite considerably by pressure.
Mm.
I remember Carragher on a piece on Monday Night Football years ago, and he just analysed Liverpool's defence through a short little sequence when we were hanging on to a lead. And he just picked out each individual decision, each individual thing that each player was doing. This was back when, like, Martin Skrtel days and things. But he was just pointing out that, like, if the match had just started, that is not something the player does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Salah's case, he's maybe feeling the pressure to score. And it's impacting his decision-making. But in terms of getting the result, yeah, it's just the most important thing. And I listen to quite a few podcasts and, like, analytics stuff and that, and it has got to that point of the season whereby XG comes into it less and just results are a bit more important. XG is obviously, an underlying performance is obviously a bit more important in the earlier stages.
Tells the story as the season's developing.
It provides an insight into what's going to happen at this point. You know, you're at a stage now where you just need results, you just need points, and, you know, say for example a team like Brighton maybe and Newcastle, they don't usually post high XG numbers, and the reason they don't usually post high XG numbers is because if they take a lead, they then stop attacking and they just sit on it. So they might lose a fair amount of games in terms of XG, but it's because of the game state at the time that they've, you know, we'll sit on this lead now. And I think that could come into it now. We may lose, not necessarily lose, but we might regress to an extent in terms of XG, and it could just be a case of making sure that we secure results and things like that. So that's by far the most important thing at the minute, just winning and progressing.
And ultimately, a 7-game sample, which is what it will become for Liverpool, isn't normally enough to garner any conclusions. So it is just going to be a case of it doesn't matter if their XG is 0.2 for the rest of the season. As long as they score the goals that win them the Premier League, that's all that will matter.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Something that might matter as well for Liverpool. I'm not going to talk about Tottenham. It's a little bit too far in the future. We don't really know. You know, anything can happen on international duty. Fingers crossed, nothing happens to any Liverpool players. But two players who should be back, well, will be back in some capacity once the international break is finished, is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and Joe Gomez. Josh, what would you do with them? Do you bed them in? Do you throw them straight in? How do you work this? I mean, we'll go twofold. First of all, very quickly on Gomez, because I think we'll talk about Oxlade-Chamberlain a little bit more. Gomez, you've got somebody there who's, what, 21, 22 now. Was a perfectly, that damns him with faint praise. He was a very good defender before he got his injury. But Joel Matip has come in and deputised better than personally I thought he could have done. I think he's definitely having the Van Dijk bounce, if you will, of being next to Van Dijk. He feels a little bit safer. But at the same time, Gomez is arguably, and you could throw Lovren in there, is arguably Liverpool's better centre-back. But it's a big ask, isn't it, for a player to come back after 3 months and throw him in against Tottenham or even, let's say, Southampton away. It's a big thing for Jürgen Klopp to decide.
Yeah, with Joe Gomez, I'd personally take my time with it. Mm. Just because he's an outstanding prospect. He's really, really capable of reaching the top. You don't usually get centre-backs who, A, are that fast, B, are that good in the duel, C, are that good in terms of playing like vertical passes through the lines and things like that. And D, the fact that, you know, very rarely do you find a centre-back who's proficient in the full-back areas too. And he can firmly operate as both to a very, very high level. And if you think of players in the modern day who can do that, there's Lucas Hernandez, I think. Benjamin Pavard as well. Not many others.
Could Kimmich play centre back?
I'm not sure on that one. I'd have to look.
Probably
he
feels like he could play centre back, but it's not. Yeah,
it's a rare trait, put it that way.
Traore at Liverpool. He was
Carragher's one, in fact.
Carragher is one, yeah.
But it's a rare trait. It's very, very valuable trait as well. And basically, a player of Gomez's profile at the minute, he's pretty special. And one worry for me is he seems to be very fragile, gets injured very easily and stuff like that. So just to ensure that we can benefit from his potential over a long period of time and he doesn't go down, say, the Michael Owen route, I wouldn't rush him in at all, especially considering, you know, how Joel Matip's performed. And the only problem would be at right back. Obviously, you'd like to rest Trent, and whenever Milner's played over there, it hasn't been great. But I just think Gomez is too special to risk.
Oxlade-Chamberlain on the other hand. Well, he's needed in this midfield potentially, isn't he? He could be the key.
Yeah, well, with Ox though, like you said, we're not going to talk about Spurs. It's unfortunate that we're not going to talk about Spurs because.
Well, we talk about Spurs if he wants, you know, no, by all means.
Well, what I mean by that is, that's the type of opponent that Ox is useful for. People talk about we need this creative midfielder and things like that, and we do. And some people have the argument that Ox is that creative midfielder. He's not. He's not the creative midfielder that we need. What Ox is the transitional threat. So I spoke last week about, you know, when we play big teams, pressing is our playmaker. And we counter-attack a lot more and we have less spells on the ball where we break a team down in possession, if you like. We're less inclined to do that, more inclined to get you on the counter-attack. And if you think of this season, when we've tried to impose that, like, transition counter-attacking style, it's been a lot less effective. If you think of Napoli away, PSG away, just matches of that nature where we've tried to adopt, not the inferior role, but we've tried to just remain compact, pressure into mistakes and then break immediately. We haven't had that player from midfield who carries the ball like a baton, like I said a couple of weeks ago, from the midfield to the attack, and Ox is that. So Ox is very, very useful against big opponents, big matches, matches where we'll look to counter and break on you rather than breaking you down with possession. So it's unfortunate that Ox won't be ready for Spurs. It's unlikely, isn't it? That
he might make the bench, but then you've had Adam Lallana, who's actually started to play decent and get a bit of game time. You've got Naby Keita, who might be coming back. He might be on the bench. I can't see him starting.
Yeah, neither can I. Who have we got after Spurs? It's not
Southampton away, former club.
See, Southampton, he may potentially be fitter for that, but then that's the game where his traits would be less useful, because obviously would dominate the ball
You're
more.
You're playing against the low block, aren't you?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know if that'll be the case with Hasenhüttl, but there's less emphasis on counter-attacking if you're playing against a weak opponent, where you're more likely to dominate the ball. And although Ox is still useful, still obviously a very good player to include, he's more valuable when we want him to just get the ball and basically just run. And that happens less against weak opponents.
He will give Liverpool's midfield something a little bit different, though, won't he? I've delved in. I know you say that he's not the creator that Liverpool need, and you know, it's for another podcast for another day about what Liverpool needs this summer. But you know, I'm firmly of the belief that they probably do need a Fekir Coutinho style midfielder still. And I think Jürgen Klopp probably agrees, given that the fact that he tried to sign Nabil Fekir last summer. But you know, just want to look at the creativity of Liverpool's midfield at the moment, and this is with the caveat that a lot of creativity does come from A, the front three, and B, the fullbacks. You know, just looking at the XG per 90 from Liverpool's midfield, and this is where they are in relation to the league for all positions, to be fair. But just worth pointing out, there's only one player in the top 50 in terms of XG, and that's Shaqiri. And even then, whether he's a midfielder or not, he's done a lot of his work as a number 10 or as wide on the right. After that, you've got Adam Lallana, who's 76th. You've got Naby Keita, who's 79th. You've got James Milner, who's 105th. I assume that doesn't include penalties, to be fair. And you've got Gini Wijnaldum, who's 147th.
This is per 90, yeah.
And then expected assists. So again, trying to look at the type of chances they're creating and how good the chances they're creating are. Milner, 29th. But he's on a lot of free kicks. I know the XA wouldn't be massive on them, but he does take the set pieces as well. Jean Shaqiri, 69th. And then the next one is Lallana, 185th. Fabinho, 186th. And Jordan Henderson, 191st. That is not a very creative, that is not a very goal-scoring midfield, is it, Josh?
No, it's not. I think we all know that. I mean, just in terms of Ox as well, providing perhaps a different element to that. The XG and the XA of Ox, based on his time at Liverpool last season, is pretty much Milner. It's not necessarily bad, but it's not, you would say, it's creative by any means. Difference between Ox and Milner is that Milner's progressive runs, which is basically like, you know, when you Matip picks up the ball in the centre back areas and drives forward with it
from A to B, isn't it? Basically, yeah, it's going vertically from A to B.
Yeah, it's when you carry the ball up the field, I suppose. Milner makes 0.8 progressive runs per 90. Ox is 2.5.
Massive.
So it's total difference there, and the stylistic nature of the two games there. But in terms of just outright creativity, expected assists and things like that, we don't really have that creator. We don't have a playmaker. Our team's the playmaker.
Well, the press is the playmaker, isn't it?
The press is the playmaker, if you like. And it benefits us to some extent, because then opposing teams don't necessarily know to pick up and stuff like that. But against teams whereby you need a key to the door, we could really do it with that kind of like Ozil kind of character, who's just gonna see a pass and things, and our midfield's full of endeavour and graft and mobility and versatility, but there's nobody there that's really gonna look up, see an incisive forward pass and play it consistently. You might get them doing it every now and then, Fabinho's done it every now and then. Naby Keita, I'm sure Naby Keita's got it on his locker, but for whatever reason, it's not really.
We haven't seen it yet.
We haven't seen it yet. But it should, I'd expect that to be on the agenda in the summer.
Definitely. You do think, though, I mean, you got to guess there, if Oxlade-Chamberlain comes back and he won't be at the level that he was at the end of last season, or certainly before his injury, but, you know, those driving runs, those progressive runs that you've just mentioned, you've got to imagine that will sort of hopefully give Salah a little bit more space as well. It feels a bit like a jigsaw for Liverpool, almost like a Rubik's Cube, where if all the pieces fall into place at the same time, it's got to be absolutely phenomenal. And it felt like Salah's best work last season came in that time when Oxlade-Chamberlain was really nailing down that, as you say, the baton role, where he was sort of driving up the pitch. He drives up the pitch. Defenders have got to commit. They've got otherwise, because he's got a decent shot on him. So that leaves someone like Salah in space. You know, we saw that against, say, Man City, for example, where in the Champions League away game, where I think it's Oxlade-Chamberlain sort of turns with the ball, drives up the field, and all of a sudden Salah's in space and can dink the ball over the keeper. So, albeit after a bit of shenanigans with Mane and Ederson. So, you know, if nothing, he might not be creative, but he's certainly going to give Liverpool's midfield something that they are lacking at the moment in terms of those driving runs. Are those two returns, you know, Oxlade-Chamberlain in particular, do you think they're defining, or what do you think will define this title race now?
I think in the case of Ox, he, depending on how ready he is, like, obviously you've got no idea what level he's currently at in terms of how readily available his talent will be, because he hasn't played a competitive match really for a year and a half or something. So it's difficult with Ox. If he can get to anywhere near his level in terms of being able to carry the ball up the field, I think he's likely to play a key part in our Champions League exploits, especially if we manage to get past Porto, because then obviously if we face Barcelona, hopefully we will, because
well, number one, Liverpool are through, and number two, for three reasons. Number one, Liverpool are through. Number two, Man United aren't.
Yeah.
And number three, both myself and Josh have booked to go to Barcelona. So, threefold.
Yeah, put ourselves on the line there, just letting the world know that we're booked our flights already. But in that moment against the likes of Barcelona, that would be when we then press into the playmaker, we sit back, we counter attack, that kind of thing. Ox would be absolutely key to that. So I'm inclined to think Ox would be more important in terms of going for the European Cup, whereas obviously it'd be important in the league as well. But in terms of Gomez, he'd just be important. He's important.
He's just an important body on the bench, even. Yeah,
he's just a key player. But
he's one of those that Klopp obviously likes as well. And I think this is the reason, as well as the fact that his contract's expired, and the reason we haven't really seen Moreno much on the bench, because I think Klopp likes those players who can play in more than one position. I think that's why he let Klein go out, because if you have Klein on the bench, he's filling one role.
Yeah.
So you've got Gomez there who can play both, you've got Milner who can play left back or centre mid, you've got these players. So I think Gomez, if anything else, will be an absolute vital substitute.
Yeah, as I said, my only worry with him is his longevity and stuff like that. I've got like fears of him eventually going down Vincent Kompany route, and you know, he comes back for the odd game and then he gets another nickel.
25
like
game
that.
Seasons.
Yeah, he's too good and he's too young as well to be anywhere near that stage. So, but you know, considering the fact that we can obviously keep going as long as we don't need him, then I personally wouldn't throw him in until it was absolutely safe to do so.
That's great. Thanks very much, Josh. That's all we'll have time for today. Thanks very much to Josh for joining me. I've been Christian. We will be back next week. We will talk about Tottenham. We will absolutely not talk about the international break because, let's face it, not many people care about England or any other country for that matter. So thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next week when we will talk all about Liverpool, of course. And until then, have a very good week. Try and relax without any Liverpool to stress your heads out. And we'll speak to you soon. Take care. Bye now.
You've been listening to the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.